Hello again, and welcome to the Luke Miller Podcast. And I am, of course, Luke Miller. And it is episode 17 of this podcast. And what we've been doing over the last little while is taking a look at genuine worship and really starting to explore what worship looks like. One of the areas in church life, in our Christian walks, that probably has the most amount of, I don't want to say controversy, most amount of opinions, absolutely. And what we've been actually doing is diving into the fact of worship being more than one, just a Sunday morning experience. And I even want to talk more about that next week. I'm really hoping that I can get our worship pastor, Rachel, on our on this podcast, and her and I can just talk about kind of the history of worship in music and really starting to understand its role. And I say this, and what triggered me to remind me, I guess, of to say this was really just this idea of most of us think, or a lot of people, I should say, think of worship as what we experience on Sunday morning. And that word experience doesn't really encapsulate what worship is supposed to look like. And so I think we've been building towards getting to a conversation on music, but I thought it would be good, of course, for us to build some foundations. And that's what we looked at last week, you know, actively participating in a life of worship. And in very much, today I wanted to just continue an understanding about how much worship is a verb in our own lives, right? God is more concerned with how we worship outside the sanctuary than we are, I think, is probably the synopsis of what I wanted to talk about. Because within a context of a Sunday morning, that's when we often find ourselves, again, worshiping, right? Whether it's through music, whether it's through prayer, whether it's through teaching. But as we take a look at today's passage, which is not in the Psalms, we're just taking a look at Romans 12, verse 1. And my aim for this is, as we take a look at this verse that is very popular, you've heard it, it's well known. And probably as you hear this, you're probably you've probably saying, "Oh, you know, I know this verse. I've heard it." It's extremely profound. I mean, if you go phrase by phrase through this one verse, you find that there is just a whole lot there. And we're going to try and parse it in 20 minutes. So we'll see how well that works, which means I'll probably say in conclusion at around the 19 minute and 50 second mark. But we're in Romans chapter 12. We're looking at verse 1. And I see it, well, let's just read it first and let's talk about it, because in it we see what worship and acts of worship look like. So, therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Now, I want to touch on a few things with this, right? Obviously, that key statement there is in that final moment where it says, this is your spiritual act of worship. Everything building up in this short verse of, in view of God's mercy, offering our bodies as living sacrifices, being holy and being pleasing to God, and understanding that all of that encompassed together is our spiritual act of worship. And so let me take a look at this, because I think the first thing that we can see here is that we really need to allow our behaviors to flow from our beliefs. Whenever you hear that word, therefore, like we see at the beginning of our passage, you should always ask, you know, what on earth is it there for? It's the old exegetical phrase that every Bible teacher says, you know, if you see it therefore, ask what it's there for, right? And that's really where we ask this, you know. It's a time where we see Paul following a similar pattern that he has done and does throughout other books. He does this in Galatians, he does this in Ephesians, he does this in Colossians. when he establishes doctrine in the first part of the letter and then moves to the application in the second half. And I think one of the things that I love about this is you see that Paul reveals that theology is never meant to be cold and lifeless, right? It's meant to have practical application. It's as if he's saying that, you know, based on everything that I've said, this is now what you need to put into practice, right? And then I think when we have this here, we can see that, again, we take a look at where Paul is leading us, and we understand that the in the context of who Paul is writing to in Romans is people who are having a very tough time gaining their foundations of who God is, who Jesus is. And so, like, to think that Paul has spent 11 chapters writing on doctrine and very core doctrine that you would, that they need to know, and he makes this pivotal shift, because it would be very easy for the book to end in chapter 11. If it ended in chapter 11, it would be a great textbook. But Paul doesn't want Christianity to be just a textbook of knowledge. And that's why chapter 12 focuses on now the behaviors, right? And asking ourselves, what do we believe, and allowing our behaviors to flow from what we believe is really what he's being, what he's pushing them to do here. And what we also see here is that there is this urgent appeal from God for worship, right? Paul says, I urge you, brothers, you know, I call you to the, you know, I call you to one side. I call you over here in order to persuade someone to do something is really what it is, an appeal. Therefore, I beg of you is another way that it could be translated. And we see this appeal come from Paul in other places as well. Even though Paul could have used the a command here, he instead makes an appeal from love, not law. And that's very important, because he's really trying to push the people in the book of Romans away from just head knowledge into action. So he makes an appeal from love, not from law, saying this is what you're commanded to do, so do it. Very similar to what we see in Ephesians chapter 4. I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. The other thing that you'll notice is that this is very personal. Even just that word brothers here indicates his affection to them as members of God's family. It's a term of warmth, and he's begging them to listen up and to take heed to what's going on. And the thing that I enjoy about this as well is that he gives them this motivation, right? And yes, it is corporate, right? This is being written to a corporate body. Yet, even within the words, we see that it is also very individually focused, right? It's a decision that disciples are going to have to make. And Paul is leaving it up to each of us individually to make decisions for how we actually live. It's important for us to understand this, that this is a call for church and for individual. And more so to be motivated by God's mercy. Paul makes this plea, right? In view of God's mercy, he says. And the original word used here for mercy is actually plural and refers to a multitude of God's mercies, not just one thing. Very similar to if we're going back to Galatians and we're looking at the fruit of the Spirit, right? How fruit is not plural. It's not fruits of the Spirit. It's fruit of the Spirit. And so you've got love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control, all considered to be one fruit, yet individuals, right? It's kind of what's happening here, or it is what's happening here. God's mercy is actually functioning as plural, understanding that God's mercies are come in a multitude of things, right? I think as we start to understand this, that we start to realize that, of course, God is merciful not once, but again and again and again. He is constantly and consistently full of mercy. I came across a quote from John Calvin that once said, "We will never worship with a sincere heart or serve God with unbridled zeal until we properly understand how much we are indebted to God's mercy." And I love that. God has demonstrated so much mercy to us that we can't help but respond by fully surrendering our lives to Him. That's the message of it, right? God has demonstrated mercy to me so many times that I can't help but respond by fully surrendering, you know, my life to Him. In the hymn "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross," we read the words, "Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all." And I think that really encompasses what Romans 12:1 is saying here, right? Love so amazing, so divine, that it demands my soul, my life, and my all. And if we really converted this in changing that line of that hymn, or one word in it that just said, "Mercy so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all," I think you would have this perfect picture of what Paul is trying to paint in this first verse. Many of us, I think, get this wrong. We think we have to sacrifice or perform to get God's mercy. And we've got that backwards. God gives us mercy apart from anything that we do. And this should cause us to surrender everything we are and sacrifice everything we have. Right? And so we need to, if we're going to enter into genuine worship, we need to realize that God's not looking, a performance from us, right? We think we have to perform to get God's mercy. We think we have to sacrifice to get God's mercy. That's a works program that, well, doesn't work. We've got it backwards, right? The moment we start understanding the mercy of God, and God gives us multitude of mercies apart from anything we do, then the natural outflowing of that is surrender and sacrifice everything that we have. Right? And that's where we come to this last part, which is offering ourselves as living sacrifices. If we take heed of everything that's happened in this short verse up until this point, then we realize that when we arrive on a Sunday, when we open our eyes on any given morning, that God's mercies will abound. And the moment we come to that realization, our worship for that day will look differently. As we surrender to Him, as we see how He has constantly shown us mercy, then all of a sudden our outlook and our perspective on the world around us looks a little different as we enter into a time of worship, and worship being a verb as what we live every hour of every day, it's going to look different when we consider God's mercies for us and the mercies that we should show others and how we should surrender to Him. I mean, Paul continues by saying holy and pleasing to God, right? Living our life offering is to be holy and pleasing to God. Sacrifices were meant to be without blemish. And if you go back to Leviticus, and the priest is to burn them, burn it on the altar. It's a burnt offering, an offering made by fire, an aroma pleasing to the Lord, right? That's the very first part of the law in Leviticus chapter 1. Talking about sacrifice. God is delighted when His people are fully devoted to Him. But having said that, if we look at the larger picture of Romans, we are already pleasing to God since Jesus died in our place. We have been declared righteous and holy because the holiness of the Son has been credited to our account as Christ followers. And I think to bring in worship into this is understanding that, you know, even on a given Sunday, the question is not, did I like the music today and did the service please me? And this is a great stepping stone into what we'll talk about next week. But the real question is my worship both here and outside the place of worship pleasing to God? Not did it please me, but are my actions pleasing to God? And that comes from a lifestyle of worship, right? I took out my calculator and I did some arithmetic, and I'm not very good at arithmetic, so I'm sure someone out there might double check for me. If we think of worship as even just the singing, and I know that we don't, but this puts it in a good perspective. You know, maybe we have 20 minutes of music every week. When we realize that there's 168 hours in the week, and if you do the arithmetic on that, there are 10,080 minutes in a week. Does God want just 60 of those from a Sunday morning service? Or even if it was just 20 minutes that we considered worship, does God want 20 minutes out of 10,080 minutes in a week? We're looking at less than 1% of our week if we count church as worship, and only as worship. Only less than 1% of that is actually, I think 0.6% of that would be how much we've worshiped God. 0.6% if we only count Sunday mornings as worship. Now, hopefully, most of us listening to this are saying, "Well, that number is not, that's way too low for the number where I am." And maybe the challenge for this week is asking, what is your number? You know? And this is a place where we're able to say where we can gain improvement and where we can work on in our walk as Christ followers, is being able to say, what, really try and think of what percentage of my week is worship. And I realize there's a large chunk of that is sleep time, and we can get into details, but I feel like the moment I start trying to parse and make excuses for different areas of my week where I don't really necessarily need to worship, I'm already going in contrary to Romans chapter 12 of living a life of sacrifice, a spiritual act of worship as living sacrifices everywhere we go. But I think, you know, what if that number was even 50%? And what if we bumped it up to 75%? Or 80% or 100%. We slowly work our way up to say, how can we be living sacrifices in every aspect and worship God in every part of our week, in every part of our life? And I can tell you what the response will be. I can tell you what the outflow of those actions would be. If we do this as a church and as individuals, you'll see revival, period. It's just as easy as that. When we are called to a life of worship, a spiritual act of worship as living sacrifices, and we go wholeheartedly into that, I can tell you, the more people who join us on God's mission is God's mission. I can tell you that it is going to be a place where revival will happen, and people will come to know Jesus, and you will hear the name Jesus being used a whole lot more around where we live as we start to live as living sacrifices. I should probably stop for there for today, but I thought, you know, it was really interesting just understanding that if we only count church as a part of our, as the only part of our worship, then we really are looking at that 0.6% of our week is dedicated to worship. So whatever that number is, it's saying, how do we make it grow? And as we look at it, and this week, as you look at it, and as I look at it, it's even asking more, where can I grow? Where can I improve? Where are areas that I need some help in my walk, in the discipleship process? And so I'll leave it with that. And And I think it's a good place to stop as we head into next week. I want to talk a bit more about music next week, and so I'm hoping you're ready to join me. And like I said, I'll try and wrangle Rachel Jackson in to this conversation and hope she'll be able to join us. But why don't I pray, and then we'll head from here. God, I just thank you for today. I thank you that we can just study your word together. I thank you that we can go through such a small verse, but so filled with a call to action. And God, I just pray that we will be able to examine ourselves and soften our hearts so we're able to see and look at who we are and who we are as Christ followers in a way where we can examine whether we are truly living sacrifices and giving it all to you as a spiritual act of worship. God, help us to see that worship is a verb that takes place 24/7 in our lives, and help us examine and figure out what that means to us. And so, God, I just thank you for today. I just thank you for the time that we're able to spend together. And we lift all these things up to you in your amazing name. Amen.